This panel has one final matter on the oral argument calendar. Just inquire quickly from the marshal whether we've heard from the lawyers. Okay. Oh, maybe here they are right now.
There's one.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. You probably noticed we're a bit off schedule today. So thank you very much for patiently waiting. And well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I'll make just a couple of quick remarks. Please take whatever time you need to settle into the council table. So the panel today is a little bit different from the one you were given notice of in that I, Judge Bradfield, am presiding. Judge Smith is here and present in the courtroom. She is participating remotely. So just so you're advised, you may hear questions that sound like they're coming, you know, from elsewhere, and that just means Judge Smith's remote participation. Obviously, Judge Cleary is here. So we are ready to proceed with the fourth matter on our oral argument calendar. Before we do so, just to keep our record clear, I'll ask the marshal to call that case.
Now calling case A230801, State of Minnesota versus Rodney Owen Schofield.
All right, and I see that both lawyers are here and present. You're probably familiar with all of our procedures. I just want to remind you of two things. First of all, when you get to the podium, take whatever time you need to adjust it. And then if you would, please identify yourself as well as the client you represent before you start your argument. We do maintain an audio recording of today's argument. It's posted on the court's website, and it just helps keep our record clear. Second thing is that the timing should be visible to you on the podium, so keep your eye on that. We very much appreciate this opportunity to hear from you, but the time tends to go quickly. With that, counsel for appellant, when you're ready to begin, we are ready.
It's afternoon, I guess, now, so I'll say good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Max Keller, M-A-X-K-E-L-L-E-R. I represent the appellant, Rod Schofield. A major issue in this case seems to be State versus Xiong, X-I-O-N-G, which the state cited from this court in 2002. And basically, their assertion is, well, if you waive the hearing, which is the term used in Xiong, but of course that's a misnomer. What they meant is if you admit the violation or violations, then you can't contest the facts. I don't think that's exactly right, because what we see in this case is the facts are being contested for the purposes of disposition. also, I take it as someone who's been in court many, many times, a practicing attorney for 25 years, after 1 year spent as a clerk here at the Court of Appeals, that when you go and admit a probation violation or violations, you make a proffer or something, which is what happened in this court. In this case, and the trial court asked the person, well, did you do this? There's some admissions to some specific facts. Either I admit violation number two or I say what I did. So it's not, I don't think it's as simple as just saying, well, you admit the violation, therefore you admit everything they claimed that you did. I don't think that's the way it is. Now, since this is about disposition, it's worth taking a common sense look about what do we actually do in court in Minnesota. We don't send people to prison for every violation. That's why in the Austin or Motlin factors, the court is required to find that in the third factor, confinement is either necessary to protect the public or it would unduly depreciate the seriousness of the violations to not impose a prison sentence, or the offender is in need of some type of treatment which can be most effectively provided if he's confined. So here's a couple of things that we don't send people to prison for that are directly relevant to this case. We don't send people to prison for taking pictures of fully clothed minors on a trampoline in the probationer's backyard that the probationer wasn't even standing next to. And we don't send probationers to prison for having, quote, contact with minors, which is what he admitted to having contact, but the contact is he's in the house or at the back door gardening, and the minors are over there on the trampoline. So, yeah, you can call that contact with minors, but we don't send people to prison for that. So then I think what it comes down to is it comes down to pornographic images, which unfortunately for me, the problem with this whole case, as I tried to point out in my brief, is in the middle of the hearing, the probation officer is testifying. The probation officer is not under oath, and a forensic examiner, which I don't imagine could be the probation officer, has made a report about what images were found on Mr. Schofield's device. And the trial court says, let me see those images. And the probation officer says, here you go. And none of us can talk about what's in there because it's not in the record. So even if I were to go to the sheriff's department and try to look at what's in there, that would be meaningless for the purposes of this argument, because the court certainly can't look at them because it's not in the record. And the state, of course, concedes that it's not in the record. I think that's in their brief in page 5. The most they can say is, well, he admitted the violation, so we're not required to show what's in the record or to show what's in the forensic exam report, excuse me. The problem, of course, is if we're arguing disposition, wouldn't you want to know what that is? So there's a lot of misstatements in there about what these things are. For example, the state's brief says he's watching pictures of children being molested. That's at the state's brief on page 5. We tried to point out that a lot of these things are not what they are claimed to be, especially by the trial court. On page 4 of our brief, we pointed out that if he was really watching videos of children being molested, then you would certainly think that he would be prosecuted for possession of child pornography, and he would get a longer sentence than for that charge than what was imposed in this case, the 54 months. Seems like what he admitted is that he had legal pictures of adult pornography, which would be legal except for the fact that he's on probation. In other words, they're legal images as long as you're not on probation. And then the trial court completely transforms that into something else. There was good evidence about positive things that Mr. Schofield has done in his life. And that doesn't mean that, of course, the trial court can't revoke, even though he's done some positive things. But the trial court was making all types of negative findings against him, which are not supported by the record. And I don't think that the state can just say, well, we're not required to prove those things because he admitted some violations. The trial court is saying, I'm sending you to prison because of these things, X, Y, and Z, and there is not support for those things in the record. Specifically, the district court erroneously found that Mr. Schofield was, quote, watching these videos of children being molested. Transcript page 33. As far as I can understand in the record, there are no videos of children being molested. Of course, again, the forensic exam report is not in the record. Similarly, the district court found that, quote, there's thousands of pictures on there of children being taken advantage of. That's transcript 34. Then, basically, the probation department and the state admit that there aren't thousands of pictures. The probation department says, well, maybe there's thousands of images, but that's like stills from this video. So that's something completely different. That's what the probation officer said on transcript page 32. Quote, we're talking thousands of images were of his son, period, videos that could be interpreted as multiple images. End quote. So that's something completely different. I don't see how the probation officer is called up to answer questions. The probation officer is not under oath. And you could say, well, no, come on. If you just ask the probation officer, like, well, you know, has Mr. Keller been on probation for 5 years or 4 years? Okay, fine. Maybe the probation officer doesn't have to be under oath. But this is exactly what happened. It may not be crystal clear in our brief, so I'm trying to make this crystal clear. For the purposes of disposition, the trial court was making credibility findings because Mr. Schofield went up there and he said A, B, and C. Okay, maybe that's not true. Maybe he was wrong. Maybe he lied or whatever. Then the trial court says, well, you, probation, you come over here. And they started asking him questions saying, basically, is what he just said true or not? And the probation department says, no, that's not true. Then the trial court sends him to prison. How can you make a credibility determination like that as the trial court if this other person who is the witness, essentially a witness, the probation officer, is not sworn in?
Counsel, wouldn't one way to have handled that would be to have a contested hearing?
Well, yes. So I've anticipated that question, Judge Clary, and I appreciate that. So clearly we have problems when we come here as appellate attorneys because we could always say, well, I would have done this, someone should have done this, but we're stuck with what was actually done. So,
no, I understand that. I just mean that witnesses would have been put under oath in that situation, whereas in a disposition hearing, Judge Bradfield and I have been district judges. I mean, people aren't put under oath when they're being questioned, probation officers. And I mean, as you know from your experience, that's a very informal hearing.
Yeah, I agree with you that a lot of times trial court judges ask probation officers questions and they're not under oath. And I appreciate arguing before appellate judges that have been trial court judges, so I do appreciate your experiences. They're not all, those circumstances are not all those in which a trial court is making a credibility determination. That's what I think is really important about this, because Judge Cleary can call me up there as the probation officer, and they can say, you know, Mr. Smith admitted doing this and this. What's your recommendation about disposition, right? Well, of course, we're not going to swear someone in there. Clearly, there's not a credibility determination being made, right? It's either ineffective assistance of counsel, which we're not arguing in this brief here, that there wasn't a contested hearing because somehow they want to eat, they want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to say, well, we can admit the violations, but we can still argue these facts, which I think you can do that because you're saying, well, I did this, but I didn't do this other thing that they say I did. And we all know, everybody in this room that has experience in trial court, we know that that happens all the time that someone would come in and say, well, I admit violation number one. I don't admit violation number two. Okay, is the state okay with that? Yes. Okay, now we're going to go ahead and argue disposition. So lots of times people are accused of all kinds of probation violations, and they say, well, I did these things. I didn't do these things. I think it makes a huge difference what these facts were because, of course, you could violate. You could even have serious violations. It doesn't necessarily mean you should be sent to prison. That's why the very first thing I wrote in the facts section here is, over 22 years ago from now, the appellant was charged with these cases and pled guilty. And at the beginning of 2002, exactly 22 years ago, he was sentenced. So it does really make a difference when these violations happened. And the trial court's statements that are in the state's brief on page 3, the trial court has a colloquy with Mr. Schofield and asks him, did you do this? Did you do this? He says, yes, yes. The trial court says, well, you possessed and accessed sexually explicit images or videos from the internet. Now, of course, she did not say child pornography. So as far as I can tell, we're talking about these were adult images. Then there's no discussion whatsoever about when. He goes up there under oath and he says, well, I looked at those things 10 or 15 years ago. If there's no contrary assertions, isn't the trial court required to conclude that that is a true statement? And to
Counsel,
your-
I'm sorry to interrupt. So can I, when I'm looking at, I mean, there's no written order here. What we have is the transcript, right?
Correct.
And the defendant decided to not have to admit the violations. And it seems to me, I mean, there is a probation report that goes into a lot more detail the violation than just, quote, access sexually explicit images. So you go into the hearing and then the court, you're saying, the court is the one who asks the question, is it true that probation received a forensic report from your computer, your iCloud account, that you possessed and accessed sexually explicit images, videos from the internet? Yes. So are you saying that the district court's question then narrowly established precisely what he was admitting to and everything else in the report is not available then? Because he only admitted to what you infer from that means sexually explicit images is adult pornography. I'm just wondering how that all works. It just seems a little bit informal to then the district court phrased the question to very much narrowly limit what he's admitting to.
Well, I take your point, Judge, and thank you for that. So I think what it is the trial court should have said, or some counsel should have said, like the state's counsel or his counsel should have said, well, do you admit that everything in the probation violation report is correct? If the person says yes, well, then that answers your question. If they say no, then someone has to say, well, what do you agree with and what do you not agree with? Because if it were a guilty plea, generally, someone's not just going to say like, oh, well, I agree with everything the state ever said. They're going to ask specific facts. Did you do this on this date and so on? I see my time has expired.
You can continue and answer the question, counsel.
I mean, that's about
And you
all
obviously do
I
have 5
say.
Minutes for rebuttal
yeah,
as well.
Thanks.
So if you'd like
thanks.
To. Okay. So counsel for respondent, we're going to, we already have reset the clock. You've got 15 minutes and we're ready for you.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Jillian Scar, Assistant Chisago County Attorney. I represent the respondent in this case, State of Minnesota. I'll be arguing that the court made specific findings on each Austin factor, which are found on page 5, 6, and 33 of the hearing transcript, and it did not abuse its discretion in determining that sufficient evidence existed to revoke the appellant's probation. The court contemplated the evidence before it and came to the correct determination that the appellant posed a threat to the public. We ask the court to affirm the district court's sentence as to count 3, revoking probation, and remand on count 3 to correct the error in the amended sentencing order. First, I'd like to clarify the standard of review. And it depends on the issue that needs to be addressed. Based on the appellant's brief, the issue is whether the district court had sufficient evidence before it to make the Austin findings. And that is a question of fact that is reviewed for abuse of discretion. I would like to address the appellant's argument and his statement that there were facts contested for the purposes of disposition. The facts were not in dispute. The probation violation report was evidence that the court properly relied on in making its Austin findings, specifically the last one, that confinement was necessary to protect the public.
Counsel, can I interrupt just for a minute?
Yes.
This is a little bit unusual in that the appellant here completed over 20 years of probation, apparently without any trouble, as far as I can see. And he would have been off probation then if it had been 20 instead of 25, but that extra few years caught him up here. And one of the issues has to do with sexually explicit material, and counsel makes a pretty good argument that I presume that was all adult, because if it had been underage, he would have been charged criminally. Is that correct?
Thank you for that question, Your Honor. I would refer to the probation violation report. He did not have an evidentiary hearing, so he did not contest the allegations that are in this report. The only thing that he really contested was whether or not the photographs of his son were sexually explicit. That's really what he contested.
Okay.
And that is not contesting whether the photos were on his devices or not. They were on his devices based on that forensic report that was completed. While it was not in the record, it was disclosed to him prior to the hearing. It was disclosed to his defense counsel. The parties had seen it. It was not secret. Everybody knew the photos that were being discussed. The court decided to view a copy at the hearing. I don't see what the legal error is in viewing that.
Is the child that he was supposed to not have any contact with underage children? Was the basis of the violation his own son?
That was part of it. So under the two violations in the probation violation report, it was accessing and possessing sexually explicit material. And there is an itemized list of what was found on his devices that constituted a violation, this violation of this condition. And it included a discussion about the photographs of his son that were taken when he was young in the bathtub. It describes them very specifically in the violation report. It also references the video camera that was mounted in his son's bedroom and the internet pornography. There was one photograph, I believe, that he viewed, and that the subject of that photograph was identified as a missing and exploited child. So that would have been child pornography, as well as pornography that, while it might not be characterized as child pornography, identified as such, it has to do with 18-year-olds.
That's okay. I don't need any more details.
Okay.
I just wondered if it was just his own son that was at issue here.
Thank you, Your Honor. It was not just his own son. There was many materials outside of those photographs that was not, from what I can tell, was not challenged by him, and those were admitted. The challenge was really whether the photographs of his son served his illness.
I get it.
So, counsel, can you speak to the argument that he wasn't asked, nor did he admit to all of the facts in the that were in the probation report? He only admitted to possessing sexually explicit material without permission, and that is the only fact that should. The other facts are not actually established and shouldn't be considered.
Thank you for that question, Your Honor. I believe that the court phrased the specific violation or the specific condition of his probation that was violated. I believe she phrased it because that was specific to the sentencing order and what was written on the probation violation report. So I believe that she phrased it in that way because this is what that was the language of the probation violation report, and she was using that language. However, based on the very lengthy probation violation report, there was more than just accessing sexually explicit material from the internet. That was concerning to the probation agent and to the state. And I would go back to that case law, Xiong, when a probationer waives their right to an evidentiary hearing on a probation violation, then that's a stipulation to the allegations in the probation violation report. So while he wanted to, as I said before, while he wanted to characterize the images of his son as innocent, the court made that credibility determination, made a determination based on his lengthy statement, based on some brief questioning, and found his statements to not be credible.
Well, okay, but we're combining things a little bit, aren't we? Because if he denied that there was any licentiousness behind those photographs, and the court wanted to find that there was, then there should have been a contested hearing, shouldn't there? He didn't admit to that. At least that portion of it. I understand he admitted to the rest of it.
I suppose he couldn't deny that the photographs were on his devices. So I suppose what would there be to contest at an evidentiary hearing? The state had the evidence. He knew what the evidence was.
He argues no sexual intent, and the court finds sexual intent, I take it, but without a hearing. Is that right? I mean...
Correct. The disposition hearing. The appellant characterized the photographs in a certain way. The probation agent characterized them in a different way and actually referred to the psychosexual evaluation that he completed as part of this case, wherein the appellant states in his psychosexual evaluation that young boys showering or bathing is a trigger for him. And so that was a concern for the probation agent, and that's why it was included under the sexually explicit material. Also, just viewing the images was concerning, and the appellant has his own characterization of the content of the photographs. The state has its own characterization, and the district court made its finding. I will also note that the court references images of children being taken advantage of. The appellant did seek out pornography of minors, as I mentioned, and as is reflected in the probation violation report, it's sufficiently described. The entire forensic report was disclosed to the appellant prior to the hearing, and the defendant was on notice of the allegations against him, and he chose not to challenge that evidence against him. There's no due process violation. He attempted to provide a mitigating explanation, and the court considered it and made its findings and made its decision. There was no abuse of discretion here. The violations tie to the underlying offense. As the court stated, they're not little violations. There was, as I've referenced, the video camera, the photographs of the appellant's son, the internet pornography that features young males enticing children to his backyard and watching them from inside the home. All of this was in the probation violation report and referenced by the court at the hearing. The court does also reference thousands of pictures, and that was clarified in the probation violation report and at the hearing. On page 32, the court asks, well, is this thousands of victims? And the probation agent says, Well, it's thousands of images that were taken from videos of the appellant's son. So, again, she uses the language that's in the probation violation report, but I don't believe that there's any error. There was no confusion. Everybody kind of knew what was being referenced there. And the amount of photos was not dispositive, I don't believe, of the district court's decision to revoke probation. It was the content of them. It was, as the court mentioned, enticing children to his property on the trampoline, and I believe failing to be forthcoming with probation and with the court when it asked the appellant some questions on the record. The appellant doesn't cite to any case law that requires a probation agent to be sworn in at a disposition hearing. And most of the comments made by the probation agent are just reiterating what's in her probation violation report. She doesn't provide any new information to the court. The probation agent prepares this report under penalty of perjury as an officer of the court. So while the agent wasn't sworn at the disposition hearing, again, what is the legal error? Where's the abuse of discretion? Forgive me. I'll just close. In conclusion, the court conveyed substantive reasons for revocation and the evidence relied upon as required by Austin and Motland. It is clear that the court contemplated the contents of the report, which was in evidence, the forensic report, the appellant's explanation, and came to a rational determination to revoke probation. And we ask that this court affirm the district court's sentences to count 4 and remand to correct the sentences to count 3. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will reset the clock for 5 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Keller, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. So with regards to credibility determinations, because this was just kind of addressed by the state, on transcript page 30, Mr. Schofield was talking about, I had a camera in my room, my son's room, so that I could see if he got up. Because I wasn't always there, I had to go to work. Then at the bottom of page 30, the court says, well, didn't probation go in there and check out what the camera can do? And page 31, line 6, the court says, probation, ? And they're asking the probation department, well, what could you see from that camera app on your phone? So again, the court is making a credibility determination, and I don't see how the court can do that. This is what the state just argued here orally is. This is true in multiple respects here with multiple findings about different things, but the state just said the appellant had one characterization of the pictures. They're talking about pornography. The appellant had one characterization. The state had another. The same thing is true with regards to this camera. Now, how does the trial court determine the facts and make factual findings without actually taking testimony under oath and then making a credibility determination? So to Judge Cleary's point, yeah, I would say there has to be a contested hearing. So either Mr. Schofield had to demand a contested hearing and he didn't, and that's ineffective assistance of counsel, and I'm not sure that that's exactly the right answer to this, or to Judge Cleary's point, the trial court has to say that, well, you admitted some of these things. You didn't admit everything that I want you to admit in order for me to make the disposition that I think is appropriate. So therefore, since you didn't agree with all these things, then I'm forced to say that we're going to have a contested hearing here, and we're going to take some testimony, because I don't know how I, as the trial court judge...
Because you don't have much time. I'm trying to figure out how this works. So you have a probation report. I'm not sure that the probation agent testified to anything differently at the hearing or spoke to anything differently at the hearing than was in the probation report in terms of the description of where the camera was, et cetera. But it seems to me that you're saying that if let's not even focus on the images, but let's say that there was like the violation was indirect contact with minors. Okay. And let's say the probation report had 10 different instances of indirect contact with minors. Are you saying that at the hearing, even though the state need not put in, if a probationer is going to admit to violating that condition, and the question is, did you violate that condition, blah, blah, blah. Yes, I did. I admit to that. So it doesn't need to be proof on. The state still needs to go ahead and get them to admit to every detail in the report that supports the violation to which he's admitting.
Well, thank you for that question, Judge Smith. It depends on what the arguments about disposition are, because if the trial court wants to say that I'm going to send you to prison because you had contact with minors 10 times, and if the appellant only admitted to having contact with minors one time, then it makes
no, it's not that he admitted one. He admitted that he had contact with minors, but he didn't go through each one during the admission part of it and say, of the 10 that are listed in the report, I admit this one, not this one, I admit this one, not this one. Well, you know, because it seems like it got set up as here was a condition and you violated it and you admit it, yes. And it didn't go through each of the detailed bits of information that would support, with respect to the images, what each image was.
Well, I think that the trial court didn't hang their hat on a contact with minors to Judge Cleary's question from a while back. Appellant was allowed to have contact with his own son. His son was living with him part-time. To try to be crystal clear about this, the big problem that I have is that is contrary to law is we have a big block quote in our brief on page 4 in bold that this is what the trial court said. The trial court basically said, I'm sending you to prison for doing this, like watching videos of children being molested. That's a quote. There's absolutely no evidence that he was watching videos of children being molested. So the trial court is hanging their hat on a whole bunch of things, these trial court's characterizations of these things, which are manifestly contrary to the evidence, like when the trial court says there were thousands of images, so maybe there were thousands of victims. That's completely wrong. That is 100% wrong. So that block quote on page 4, the trial court is telling us what the trial court hung its hat on, and what the trial court hung its hat on is wrong. That's just completely wrong. So we would ask that you...
And is this to be remanded? Sorry to interrupt you. You want to reverse and remand for a contested hearing? Is that it?
I think that's the only way it could happen. The last thing I wanted to say is obviously we agree, the parties agree that the sentence on, I believe it's count 3, is wrong. So... yes, count 3. So we all agree that sentence would have to be vacated because he had already served his sentence on that 20 years ago. So thank you.
Anything further from the panel? All right, doesn't sound like it. Thank you very much, counsel for appellant, counsel for respondent. We appreciate hearing the arguments that you gave to the court today. This matter is now submitted to the court for a decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. So that concludes our calendar for today. This court is now in recess.
All rise.